So I thought I'd first kind of start on this kind of drawing the problem we're interested in. So you have that in the back of your mind. I'll show you some experiments that I think are relevant to that problem, and then I think it'll be clear where at least a modeler could help us think about it. So the question has to do with synaptic specificity, which is to try to understand how you end up wiring up a circuit that has a lot of different elements. And up front, the cells don't necessarily know what their current partners are going to be. And I'll tell you a little bit about how people have tended to think about it in fairly general terms, but exactly how it happens, I think it's not really known. So let us imagine that there are two neurons over here. I've got a little different kinds. And this neuron in the end is going to receive input from one group of axons. There's another axon that's going to receive input from one.
Could you warn me, mic for the recording?
Sure, I would like to record me on mic myself. Is that good?
Do you want to do something? Okay. Is that good?
Yeah.
Great. And there's another cell that makes a synapse over here. And there are a lot of synapses like this that then goes on and doesn't make synapses over here, right? So in the end, there's going to be a synaptic connection over here, and then a connection over here, and one over here. And we imagine that early on in development, these axons have access to all of these postsynaptic cells. So within a small region of the brain, it's probably likely to be the case that the axon can contact a lot of different cells. And eventually, it is going to settle on a set of connections that is important for the network to function properly. And we're interested in trying to understand what it is that allows the cells to select their correct partners, and how the system ends up settling on this pattern of connectivity. Now, the other thing I want you to keep in mind, which I think is going to turn out to be important, but its exact significance, I think, is still unclear, has to do with the general development of each of these synapses. So to a first order, a glutamatergic synapse looks like this. It has presynaptic vesicles that have glutamate in them. And on the postsynaptic side, there are two main kinds of receptors. There are AMPA receptors and NMDA receptors. Most of the current in the adult is carried by AMPA receptors, which allow sodium to come in. And the NMDA receptors are permeable both to calcium and sodium, but as a lot of you know, that opening an NMDA receptor is harder than opening an AMPA receptor, so it's usually the depolarization provided by AMPA receptors that allows the NMDA receptor open. So in the end, all of these synapses are going to look like this. They'll have this kind of a property. Now, the thing that I want you to keep in mind is that if you look early in development, most of the synapses have a lot of NMDA receptor and very little AMPA receptor. So when the circuit is first beginning to be established, the dominant receptor is of this kind. And when the circuit is functioning in the adult, they all look like this, and most of the current is being carried by the AMPA receptor. And so one of the things that you can contribute to is to help us think about how or why is it that having low AMPA receptor synapses might be useful in wiring up the system when it is first beginning to develop.
It's insects,
they're not NMDA receptors, but some other mechanisms. I don't know, I don't work on insects. Is there someone here who knows about insects and NMDA receptors? Insects have NMDA. Okay.
So insects have NMDA.
Thought that glutamate was peripheral in insects and acetylcholine was central, is that right? That's still correct though, right? So maybe that's what you're referring to.
Wait, so
it's not a CNS.
Central ganglion in insects, what's the principle neurotransmitter? is glutamate the principal, is that a cholinate principal, is that a primary transmitter?
Cholinate and glutamate are both.
They're both. Okay, so the six central vein, they have glutamate.
Yeah, what's significantly different is in the peripheral nervous system, glutamate is common in insect birds and mammals, or vertebrates, or with different people. That's a major difference, as far as I understand.
Wait, I mean, talk about this dogma, I mean, the primary amplin secondary, so it's not just mature, amplin gets recruited.
What do you mean, primary and secondary?
Sort of is needed for your
skin
and learning.
So I'm not sure if that principle has been examined.
Are you talking about insects or do you
have synapses with no AMPA, for example, like silent synapses, right?
Okay.
And then they recruit AMPA or they stay silent in certain stuff, but you need to have an MDA.
No, you don't need to have an MDA. If you get rid of an MDA receptors in the mouse, you have perfectly good AMPA receptors and AMPA-mediated synaptic currents.
But you're saying here that as circuits mature, synapses begin by having an MDA receptors which require both a neurotransmitter and a voltage change on the postsynaptic side.
Yeah, so the early NMDA receptors, although there's a subunit difference, by and large, have standard NMDA-like properties. In other words, they'll have NMDA-IV curves.
So at the beginning, they do have this coincidence detection property of meeting voltage. Okay. And then the question you posed to everybody is this other kind of receptor that's open at all voltages, the AMPA receptor. Your question is, why aren't they there at the beginning? Is that what
you're saying? So the question is essentially, how do properties of synapses or developmentally changing properties of synapses help solve the wiring problem, right? And what I told you are essentially two properties. One is that initially there are going to be incorrect synapses and correct synapses, for which there is some evidence, and I'll show you some more evidence in a particular system in a minute. And the other property, which I think is very general, and Holly has done a lot of this work, which is that if you look across synapses in the CNS, they tend to have small AMPA to NMDA ratios early on, and the AMPA current increases. So it is truly a general developmental organizing feature of synapses. Right?
So
now, I don't know, because there's not a good experiment, to say whether or not computationally or mechanistically it helps to have that kind of property in the young synapses. Because if you had all synapses, early synapses, a lot of AMPA receptors, maybe it would be a harder problem to solve.
Well,
so, for instance, the absence of AMPA receptors might have to do with the fact that you're using NMDA receptors to make some developmental decision about forming a connection. Maybe having AMPA receptors is a bad thing because it contributes noise, or it needs there to be less of a difference between a no and a yes.
Right. I mean,
all these receptors are on the desiderium calcium all the time.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, what I was looking for, and I think that, I don't mean to imply it's not a problem that's not studied, but I think it's a problem that's particularly fruitful for theoretical investigation, is that if someone over here said, okay, well, if you were to model it, or maybe known based on some known modeling principle, that when you have a young network, if the gains are set at a certain level, it makes it harder to kind of refine the rules than if the synapses tend to be of this kind.
Right, so if the trigger signal is calcium concentration, if the two levels of signal that are possible are 0 and 1, that's an easy thing to figure out. If the two levels of signal are 1 and 2, that's a harder thing to figure out.
Yeah, so it's possible. On the other hand, I think one could probably solve the problem with standard AMPA and NMDA receptors right from the beginning.
If you have some calcium detecting mechanism, like some guy, some protein there that likes calcium, if there's a little bit of calcium in it, it might be hard to tell the difference between a little calcium and a lot of calcium, then from, baseline and coincidence detection.
Possible, right. Okay, so there are essentially two things that I want to discuss today. One is to talk a little bit about how, in a very simple system, this specificity of synaptic connections is achieved, just so that we know something about the developmental history of this problem. And in the second part, I want to talk a little bit about the role that the AMPA receptor itself might play in regulating the stability of synapses. and that maybe this developmental increase in AMPA receptors has a more direct role synapse stability. Now the problem, okay, so first of all, so we're all on the same page. We're talking about synapses. Here are two neurons that are connected. They're communicated by synapses. The synapse looks like this. It has a presynaptic terminal with lots of synaptic vesicles, and it has a postsynaptic specialization in CNS synapses, usually called the postsynaptic density, that has a number of proteins that are associated with the receptors, with the neurotransmitter receptors that eventually mediate the current. And this is important to remember because it's not just a matter of having neurotransmitter receptors that open and close and allow ions to go through, but there are several proteins in the side that probably play a role in determining the properties of the synapse. The problem that we're discussing is shown schematically over here, which is that you have a neuron that extends an axon into an area where it has a choice of several postsynaptic partners. And in this particular example, this black neuron wants to make synapses with the red neurons, but not with the yellow and blue neurons. And the question is, how does it achieve this? And does it know right from the beginning what the right targets are, or does it make a lot of mistakes and eventually refine the right kinds of connections? Now, there is a canonical view of how this problem is solved, but I just want to kind of remind you about what the evidence is and why it does not exactly address this problem. So first of all, practically in the CNS, studying the development of circuits is complicated because any given axon is contacting thousands or hundreds of thousands of postsynaptic neurons. And for even a single neuron, it is very difficult to fully evaluate what its complete connectivity is. So it is not a very straightforward thing to determine at any given time what are all the synaptic partners of a particular neuron. Now, there are a couple of places where the development of synapses has been examined closely and I think has been very influential in our thinking of it. So one is this concept of synapse elimination. I think probably best studied at the neuromuscular junction, where a single muscle fiber initially receives input from multiple motor neuron axons, and eventually most of those synapses are removed until one muscle fiber receives input only from one axon. So there are examples where a neuron will go from a polysynaptic innervated state to a monosynaptically innervated state. In the CNS, I think the best example is polyinnervation of the Purkinje neuron, which initially receives input from multiple climbing fibers, and eventually all of the climbing fibers are eliminated except for one, so that it is then innervated by one input.
That's funny, though, because a Purkinje cell receives one climbing fiber that makes hundreds of contacts. Yeah. There's something about that signaling process in which the postsynaptic cell or whatever has to be able to tell that multiple terminals came from the same.
Yeah, right.
So that's a weird one, right?
Yeah, but one of the few good examples in the
sure.
CNS where you clearly can
right.
see the process of elimination.
You don't get like one climbing fiber integrating half the arbor, and then
right.
climbing fiber integrating other half the arbor. There's something interesting.
Yeah,
right?
that allows it to keep the right synapse.
The coincident origin of signaling from the climbing fiber has to be conveyed to the postsynaptic cell.
That's right.
Right.
Now, in both of these examples, which I think have been generalized to assume that this kind of mechanism has happened a lot, and maybe elimination of incorrect synapses is how most of these circuits get formed, is that in both of these cases, there really isn't a cell type choice that is being made. So in the case of motor neurons and muscle fibers, the whole thing is between motor neurons and muscle fibers. And there are multiple cells of one kind innervating a particular target, and some of them get eliminated. In the climbing fiber, that is also the case. And I do not know of a very good example in the CNS where it has been definitively shown that there are incorrect cell type choices that are then eliminated by this kind of mechanism. But I think many of us think that this must be the case because I think that's the way those initial observations were generalized. Yeah.
What do you mean by incorrect? Because there is many different ways in which you could wire a cortical circuitry and it would still perform the same function or a very similar function. There is a lot of redundancy if you study an artificial neural network.
But in a real neural...
In many different ways, I mean, there are some changes that would be relevant. They would change the functionality of the network, but there are many changes that do not. So I do not quite understand your concept of a correct versus an incorrect.
Okay.
There are many is it a general problem to find the
cortical cortex? That's very good. So I'm sure that it is possible that theoretically one can solve the problem in many different ways. But if you look at a cortical network, for example, there are certain rules that are always found to be followed. For example, the relationship of interneurons and principal neurons in a particular part of the cortex. Neurons that convey feed-forward inhibition versus feedback inhibition. Interneurons that make very, very specific connections onto particular parts of the principal neurons. So in fact, when you look from brain to brain to brain, these features of connectivity are always found. So it is not the case that from brain to brain, each brain has solved it in a different way, right? And that's what I mean by
there are rules, but there are many different specific wirings. So, if I was looking at data, I would have to say, I want to tell you exactly who is connected to whom in this particular piece. I want to give you the full connectivity diagram. There will be many connectivity diagrams that are compatible with those rules.
You need to specify the connectivity. That's why I was focusing on the cell type specificity, right? So, in other words, you'll find a principal neuron or interneuron of a certain type always connect to a particular principal cell type. Right?
Now that's what you meant by correct or incorrect.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what's observed.
So I'm talking about cell type specificity. Okay. And
as opposed to, say, CLDNs where there, in fact, is no variation in the connectivity diagram.
Right. So I think that in the CNS, there's good evidence that there's cell type specificity connectivity, and that's kind of the
way. This kind of thing could be working elsewhere as well. So, for instance, you cited examples where you can look and see that sort of thing had to have happened. So you can imagine you're using these as extreme examples where it's obvious that it's happened. So for instance, I'll just pick an example. From CA3 to CA1 in the campus, the typical number of contacts made by a CA3 axon as it crosses all the CA1 axons, right? Like CA3, that's one two neurons are connected, there's one contact.
Right.
Now, if that number of contacts, let's say, were Poisson distributed, we'd say, well, it's just some random process of probability. But what if we discovered that there was always one?
Exactly.
You can imagine places that it's going to show up.
Right. In fact, I would imagine, I mean, my guess would be that as the circuit reconstruction problem gets more and more refined, there will be additional rules that we will discover that we don't even fully recognize right now, that are kind of numerically invariant, perhaps.
So the tip of the iceberg is these ones that we saw just by skimming
looking at them. I mean, that's also true. I mean, in cortical development, there are many examples of projection neurons which initially elaborate sets of connections and probably synapses that are subsequently retracted and removed.
Yes, and I wanted to mention that example. So that it's very important, and I think that...
I mean, that's almost a general rule.
Yeah, but I think that even in that rule, that example that a lot of us take for granted and use as an example, I am not convinced that there is a good experiment that shows that there are mistakes in cell type connectivity that are refined. So I would say one of the best examples it has to do with pruning of thalamocortical connections in layer 4, right? Yeah, many of you probably have seen these axons that grow all over layer 4, and then as time goes on, they refine into ocular dominance columns. Right? So first of all, they're always restricted in layer 4. Now, it is clear that as part of the pruning, almost certainly they're eliminating some synapses. But it is not really clear that in the incorrect places, they're making synapses the wrong target cell type. Right.
Again, by wrong target cell type, he means a cell type that's not seen in
that. Right. Right.
And so it's like the neuromuscular junction. In a sense, you said that all the motor neurons are basically making too many synapses with the same kind of muscle.
Yeah.
So, as opposed to a situation where you have cell A that normally makes a connection with X, but it's given a choice between X, Y, and Z. Does it ever make connections between
Y and Z? Right.
Two cell types that are too clearly very different in terms of the transmitters they make, the genes they express, the other cells they make.
Right. So I would say that in that case, it's really not known, although clearly there's pruning going on, whether the cell ever makes connections with Y and Z. And it's something that will be important, I think, and help justify the reconstruction efforts. Yes.
I don't know if anybody's ever done this experiment, but how about in a culture system?
I'm going to talk about a culture system, yeah. And in part we're doing it, and I'm using it to justify the culture system, because I think that in vivo these are questions that right now we can't really answer very, very well. Now, another example that's often cited, yes?
Continue what Sarah was asking.
Yeah.
So, when you define the
incorrect wiring compared to what, you know, generally happens, even salt, you know, incorrect salt to cell types. Do we have an evidence that this results in incorrect behavior, in incorrect function necessarily?
So I mean the way when you make it happen, for example, but like, I mean, in a binocular deprivation experiment where the axons are not pruned, the animal is functionally blind. It falls off the table. Right? So in other words, there physically you can see that the axons are in the wrong place. And it did not have a way to figure out what the wiring should be so that the animal could see.
Yeah, only neuromuscular junction, if you have improper synapse location, you don't have good modulation of the amount of force.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Now, another point that I want to make is that people have often used evidence to imagine refinement of connections going on that might not be happening at the level of elimination of synapses necessarily. So refinement of receptive fields is another very common feature of developing systems, right? Just like the change in amplitude and amplitude ratio. So in the visual system, most places wherever you look, you'll find early on there are cells that have big receptive fields and presumably poor vision. Over time, the receptive field becomes smaller and vision improves. Now, that problem, to a very significant extent, can probably be solved by modulating synaptic strength of existing connections. So you could make a circuit, and this is probably more like the way the modelers might do it, where you have a bunch of interneurons, a bunch of principal neurons that are wired up. And then by changing the efficacy of connections in those neurons, you can change the behavior of the circuit substantially without requiring changes in physical connectivity, right? So these two examples, just to make the point that I think although we know that there is refinement in the functional circuits as well in anatomic rearrangement of axons, in many cases we don't really know whether cells in fact can make connections with incorrect targets and then prune it down to the correct target, and then how that might happen. Yeah?
Well, I have to start by disagreeing with your initial premise. I know what you want to talk about is about specificity of target cell type selection. Mm-hmm. However, if you voice it in the context of axon pruning, I think that there's a huge amount of misinformation in that field. And so, for instance, the example you cited, that everybody knows that in, say, early mammalian visual system development, the geniculocortical axons have large arbors and those are pruned. I think that's true.
Well, even for single axons you're talking about, right. So what is clearly true is that the field of innervation refines, right? So the single eye injection experiment, I think, is very reliable, right? Which is if you look at where the inputs of one eye project to in their four.
Right, but that does not mean that problem does not happen.
By single, absolutely, right.
It could just be redistribution of.
That's right.
Without a change in that number.
Not a demonstrate that it's not true. And Antonini and Stryker showed that was the case. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation in that field that has to do with axon pruning. So I just want to make that statement because, in fact, that's not what you're going to talk about. You're going to talk about target selection.
Right. Independent of proof, I agree. I think that in that particular case, axon pruning might play a small role. But somehow you have to eliminate the inputs onto the abnormal column.
Just naively.
Right. So if you do a single eye injection experiment, right, and look at where the projections from that eye are in cortex, you get uniform labeling in layer 4. This is Schatz and Stryker, right? If you do the same experiment in a 6-week-old mouse, you get very clear ocular dominance distribution. So it is clear that there is a refinement in the projection, in the anatomical projection that's happening.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily mean you start out with an arbor like this and you end up with an arbor.
Yeah, but you have to somehow rearrange, right?
Yeah, okay.
So are you arguing about the rearrangement as opposed to a lowering of the density?
Yeah. Okay.
So we got interested in trying to ask whether or not we could study this process of refinement in a reduced system, because I thought that, well, maybe the simplest way to ask it is to have one neuron with a choice of two neurons, one that's a correct and incorrect target, and see whether or not the cell can distinguish between those two cells, and how it ends up doing it. And so we ended up deciding to do this experiment in the hippocampus. And the reason for it was that the connectivity was very well defined. So you knew what the right synapse ought to be, and that there were relatively few cell types involved. So this is familiar to most of you, but I'll just review it so that we're all on the same page. This is a schematic diagram of connectivity within the hippocampus, the excitatory connectivity. So the cells in the dentate gyrus, called granule cells, extend axons that innervate the CA3 neurons. They innervate all the cells all the way up to this point. These are all CA3 cells, but they do not innervate the cells that come right after it, which are in the CA1 region. The CA3 neurons themselves make synapses both onto CA3 cells as well as CA1 cells. CA1 cells go on and make connections with cibiculum, and then that goes on to the entorhinal cortex. And so these neurons, for example, are growing, and they reliably innervate CA3 neurons, but they do not normally innervate CA1 cells. And so we became curious about whether or not this is a choice that this individual neuron can reliably make. And we wanted to know whether it could make it independent of the kind of the anatomical privilege that this structure has when it is in vivo, right? So these axons growing out first are encountering CA3 neurons. So you might imagine, well, they grow and they just make synapses onto the first cells they run into, and they never see these cells. And so a more reasonable test of specificity would be to ask that if the spatial difference is not present, as in a culture experiment, can a dentate neuron distinguish between these two cell types? Okay, so this is a very simple cell type choice experiment, and we decided to try to reconstruct it. Yes?
That kind of choice, if I recall correctly, can go the other way in the sense you can have axons that would normally hit around the visual cortex. Let me correct me if I'm wrong, this is something I should be learning right now. If you take away from the visual cortex, they can keep on going.
Yes. That's an important point. So that has to do with this issue that if you do not have the primary target available, I think in many cases the axons will make a synapse somewhere else. Okay, which is slightly different from what I'm asking. What I'm asking is if this cell is given a choice of CA3 and CA1, so both of those targets are available, will it pick CA3?
Yeah, and again, we'll come back to your point you made before. It's not clear whether then molecularly the alternative that those neurons are opting for is any different from the neurons they would have been doing. Maybe exactly the same.
Right.
So you want to know what the CA3 neurons take.
That's right. Okay. And so... So the way we decided to do it is we thought that we needed to have a small number of neurons where we can evaluate every connection that's present. And so to do that, the way we have been doing these experiments is to make a small island of glial cells, which serves as a substrate, on top of which we can culture a very small number of neurons. My initial version of this experiment was literally a 3-neuron experiment, but it turns out that reliably getting 3 neurons on an island is just hard to do. So typically these are 10 to 20 neuron experiments, a very small network. So it's one that one can probably model in detail and certainly examine in detail. And on this little island, we played between 10 and 20 hippocampal neurons, and in every case, we have all three cell types present. So we have dentate, CA3, and CA1 cells. And then we transfect these cultures so that a single dentate neuron is transfected with a reporter either that will show us its morphology or that labels the presynaptic terminals of that cell, typically by expressing a synaptophysin GFP construct, synaptophysin being a protein that is associated with presynaptic vesicles, that would allow us to see where the cell was making its synapses. And then a few days later, as the network develops, we can ask, what did that one cell do? And the reason we can address this reasonably in culture is that we have markers that will uniquely identify each of the cell types in culture. So at the end of the experiment, we don't have to guess what the cell types are. We can say, based on, for example, expression of this marker called PY that's expressed only in CA3 neurons, or PROX that is expressed only in dentate neurons, that in a field with a bunch of neurons, we can tell which cell is which cell type. Right. So in all of these experiments, then, we are scoring only cultures where every cell type is represented and a single neuron is transfected. And this is an example of one of these experiments at the end of 2 weeks. So in this case, this neuron over here is a dentate neuron that's been transfected with synaptophysin GFP. Since only one neuron is transfected, every little GFP function we see over here, we know came from this one cell. And this field has about 20 neurons or so, and the different colors just tell us that we can tell what the different cell types are within this field. And so you'll see that there's a neuron transfected over here. It's making a few synapses over here, a few over here. And so if you zoom in on this little area, you'll see what we typically see, which is that there are synaptophysin GFP puncta associated with dendrites of some of these postsynaptic, some of these cells in culture. There are other neurons that are nearby which do not receive synaptic input. Okay. So now you can go back and use the markers to identify all the cell types and ask that if you give the cell some time, does it go and tend to make synapses with a particular cell type, or does it make synapses everywhere?
If we switch slides, the big blobs of GFP, those represent multiple synapses?
Yeah, very likely. I think that if you have a big blob like this, there are probably multiple terminals in one site. Without doing EM or something like that, we can't tell exactly what the, you know, what the
if you know, if you have a distribution of synapses and sizes, I'm surprised. I thought there would just be one synapse per region.
No, I think these sizes, in fact, there's a pretty close correlation between the distribution of size of these puncta and whether or not they tend to be stable or whether they tend to be true synapses. So this kind of experiment has been done in various systems previously, not necessarily looking at cell type specific targeting, but in terms of looking to see whether or not they can target the real presynaptic inputs, and that's pretty well established, and the larger puncta tend to be associated with true synapses.
Can you tell us how this changes in time?
Yes.
That dendrites covered in terminals, and you just are seeing one cell's contribution.
This is one, exactly. These are all puncta coming from one presynaptic axon.
What I'm saying is like those dendrites are covered in other ones that we can't see.
Exactly. These are getting inputs from lots of other cells as well that we can't see. Right?
Can you make a movie and see the synapses? Maybe the synapses are made for those wrong cells.
Yeah.
And they disappear very fast.
Yeah, they do. And so I don't know if my movie's working or not, but they do make synapses wrong cells. And they disappear with some at a certain rate, but they're also eliminated from the correct cell type as well. And so and it kind of, I think, has implications for how the circuit might end up evolving. So many of the early synapses, I think, are quite transient. Okay. So when you pool a bunch of these experiments and then look at the number of presynaptic puncta that are associated with the different cell types, what you find is that the cells in this particular setup show a strong preference for their correct target. So these are all outputs of dentate neurons in contact with other dentate cells, CHD cells, or CA1 cells. And so these are the total number of puncta per postsynaptic neuron. You can see that it has a strong bias for the CA3 cell. If you normalize it to length of dendrite, because not all of these cells have the same overall length of dendrite, so that you're not just counting more synapses because there's more dendrites, you still see a preference for CA3 neurons. And then if you just count the total number of cells per island on average to make sure that this is not because there are more CA3 cells in the islands, you find that in the islands on average there are actually more dentate cells. So each island on average has about 20 neurons, 10 of them being dentate, and maybe about 4 each, maybe 18, 4 each being CA3 or CA1. Yes?
So
can you show
that there is some cell type
preference.
If you tried to remove this within a particular cell type, is there any evidence that that this runs like a particular cell rather than
like within the CA3 cells? Is it
accurate with CA3 means that they prefer cell number 7 to cell number 8?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
So the answer is we don't know whether within that population there's a preference. In part, we don't really have a good way of distinguishing between the CA3 cells, although they're probably not all identical. We haven't quantified carefully yet as to whether or not the distribution within the CA3 cells would fall within some kind of normal distribution, or whether there's some cells that receive most of the inputs, if that's what you're saying, right?
There's only three CA3 cells in the culture.
Excuse me?
you only think about three cells?
Yeah, but within that, I don't know if they're equally distributed among four cells. I think maybe that's the question.
Are you asking if there's some kind of cause that into those cells that can make a
Yes, in this case, I actually don't know whether they're biased for one, you know, a subset of the CA3 cells. But do you want to make a comment on it, or yeah, clarify? Yeah, and there, I mean, in there might well be. I mean, certainly there are mechanisms that might favor coincident activation of a single neuron, but I don't know if that's the way this is working.
Understand this is that, you know, it's clear is that we cannot register some of that information in the genome to tell which neuron, which specific neuron is attached to which specific neuron, right? So it's only type that might be coded.
Exactly, that's right.
And it would be useful to see that indeed, you know, well, type is conserved, the specific cell, you know, is not right.
Right. Yeah.
We shouldn't really spend time on sort of figuring out which exact cell talks to which exact cell.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I think that certainly.
That's another problem. I mean, the assumption behind this, right, is that CA1 and CA3 are molecularly distinct cells, right? Is, for example, in the hippocampus, is there any topography in terms of interaction? So
yes, there is.
So guys that are here that are closer to the innervate CA1 neurons that are, you know, closest to them or something like that.
Yeah, well, so the CA3-CA1 topography is actually very nice. It almost is like a retinotectal thing. And,
so that's a completely different mechanism.
So it could be that you could overlay, you know, although you might not be able to address a particular cell, a combination of topography and cell type selectivity might get you very close to a handful of neurons, right?
Is the dendritic neuron splitted more, or like you're, when you're doing electroporations, those you are counting the dendritic on that particular place, those who are actually electroporated.
Yes.
So is the all the neurons are splitted equally on the plate?
Yeah, so what happens is that, so this distribution reflects what we end up typically getting, and this is somewhat of a consequence of dissection. I think when we first started to set it up, we probably would have preferred to have them all equal numbers of dentate, CA3, and CA1. The dentate is a very dense structure in terms of cell number. It has a lot of neurons, and so compared to CA3 and CA1, so as a result, we end up getting somewhat more dentate cells per culture than CA3 or CA1. In terms of transfection, the way it's actually done is that it's done blind, right? We can't really target a particular cell type. So we only select those islands in which a single cell is transfected, and then we just analyze those where that single cell happens to be dentate. So there are a lot of other cultures that are sitting unanalyzed right now where we have single CA3 or CA1 cells that are labeled. Okay? All right. So what... Yeah. Can transfection affect the choice that the cell makes? Well, let me show you one experiment that says that independent of transfection, it can make the right choice. But it doesn't rule out the possibility that transfection might also affect the choice, right? So another way of looking at this is to ask that if we did this experiment instead of anatomically, we did it by paired recording, where you have these little micro islands, and you take two neurons at random, you give the presynaptic cell an action potential, look at the postsynaptic response. And then after the experiment, you fix this island and ask, what is the identity of the pre- and postsynaptic cell? And then go and look at all the ones where the presynaptic cell is dentate, you can ask whether or not the responses tend to be higher when the postsynaptic cell is CA3. Right? So in this case, we are not perturbing the system ahead of time. And this is an example of that kind of experiment. And what we find here is something that is consistent with anatomical data, which is that when the dentate is presynaptic, the evoked response on CA3 is routinely much stronger than the evoked response when the postsynaptic cell happens to be dentate or CA1. Right? So it clearly shows a functional difference in terms of the synaptic response it elicits on different cell types. So whereas the transfection procedure could technically have some influence. I don't think that's what's driving this process. Okay. So what these experiments tell us is that in a very reduced system, it is possible for a single neuron to show cell type preference. And so then we can use this model as a way of learning something about how, at least in this case, that preference came about. And maybe those rules will turn out to be generalizable to a situation in vivo.
Just to follow up on Ilya's question, yeah. It's known that in the culture these cells act in identical ways to the brain, and it is similar chemical cues and environments.
So the way they act, I don't know if they act identically the way they act in the brain, but what we can say is that they show a pattern of synaptic maturation that resembles what happens in the brain, which is that they start out with very small amp occurrence, the amplitude and amplitude ratio increases over time, and they
morphologically look like
the cells in the brain.
Their wiring theory is
three-dimensionally altered because they're not in the same structure, but
you never get a hippocampus.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if it remembers anything. So one thing one can ask is to look at the development anatomically of the dentate neuron as it is making the cell type choice, and to see whether or not, just in terms of behavior of the axon arbor, one can say something about how it might be selecting the right targets. So here's an example of a time-lapse session over 7 days where a single neuron is being examined once a day, and its morphology is being reconstructed each of these times. And then on top of that, I've overlaid the positions of all the other cell types in the culture. So you can see the dentate, CA3, and CA1 cells, just to show that in a given island, all the cells are present. So this neuron, in the beginning, by day 5, already has a pretty extensive axon arbor over here. Between day 6 and 7, it gets rid of the branches that are present over here. These never come back. And then it tends to develop an arbor in this little zone over here, so it doesn't like grow all over the place. And then if you look, it doesn't really change that much over the last 4 days or so, although the number, if you look at individual branches, you can see a lot of extension and retraction. Right? Now, what I want to tell you, what's important, is that the synapses become functional at around day 7. So if you record from the cells all the way up to a week, you really don't evoke very many synaptic responses. At about day 7, you can evoke synaptic responses, and those are present throughout this period. And then if you look at detail at the cells that it is physically contacting at any given time between here and here, the physical contact of the axon and the dendrites of the postsynaptic cell do not allow you to predict connectivity. Right? So I just want you to distinguish this between the synaptic connectivity that I showed you in the first slide. Right? So here we're just asking whether physically it removes its axon from the dendrites of the incorrect ones, and that doesn't seem to be the case. And as you can clearly see here, that it really is maintaining a lot of these arbors and maybe even elaborating some more. So of the dendrites that it contacts, both correct and incorrect, it ends up maintaining synaptic contact with a subset that happens to be the right subset. Okay. So then this brings me to the question of how this develops. So one way we can look at it is to look at the distribution of presynaptic inputs onto the different cell types at two different time points. One right after the synapses first become functional, one a little bit later, by which time there's a clear synaptic preference. And this slide shows that if you look at day 8, which is about a day or two after the synapses first became functional, the cells have inputs onto all of the cells that they have access to. Right? So by day 8, it has a pretty well-developed arbor, it's contacting all the cells, and it has anatomically differentiated presynaptic inputs onto all the cells. And by 12 days, this distribution has shifted so that there are fewer inputs onto the incorrect ones. The ones and the correct ones is about the same.
This again, sorry, yeah. This is defined by synaptophysin.
Yeah, this is by synaptophysin staining, and so what we think is going on is that it makes at least these presynaptic inputs onto these different cell types at an early point, and then as a population seems to get rid of these within about 4 days.
How do you tell the difference between synaptophysin, which is transported, versus the one which is synthesized?
Okay. So I actually get to that set of experiments in a minute. So, which is not over here, which is to look at the correlation between the synaptophysin and GFP and the postsynaptic receptors that are present. But it's a good point, because I think the synaptophysin and GFP population overall includes those that are being transported and those that are stable, right? So in this distribution, this would probably include both of those things. Yes?
How informative do you think about the situation in vivo? We were discussing a bit earlier this interest in topological arrangement that happens in vivo to go from the dental to the CA1 and CA3.
Yeah.
Of course, there is no such spatial organization here, so obviously there are other things happening in vivo in terms of axon guidance that are not being reflected.
That's right.
So can you take these results and say, because I see this, I believe that something like that is happening in vivo also?
So I'll tell you how I think about it. So I think that to some extent, what we have done is we have gotten rid of those axon guidance like cues that are present in vivo that probably help set up topography and so on, so that we can look at this choice issue in a kind of a model system, right? And in vivo, I think that this particular choice probably is most relevant maybe at the border, where the axon is choosing, you know, when it gets to the end of the CA3 and doesn't innervate CA1. That might be one place where it's relevant, but I think it's probably going to be a better model for cases like the cortex, where it is intermixed, where there are a lot of inputs intermixed. But right now, we don't have a good way of kind of doing this experiment in the cortex, which is where I think it should eventually be done. Okay, so we know that the cells have a way of refining their connections onto the right cell types. That this happens at a time between the time when the synapses first become functional and when they have big evoked EPSCs. And so one experiment we have done is to ask whether or not there's a contribution of synaptic activity to this process of refinement. Now, I should start by saying that I'm quite convinced it'll turn out to be the case that these cells, different cell types, have different cell surface molecules that strongly bias what the connectivity is going to be. However, I think it is possible that you still need an activity component to either act together with those molecular signals or to help execute the molecular signal so that you eliminate the set of connections that you don't want to keep. And one possibility is that the spontaneous activity in the culture helps drive the process of refinement, right? So we can do an experiment where we block NMDA receptors during this period of refinement and ask whether or not that has an effect on the distribution of connections onto the different cell types. And what we find is that, particularly for the dentate cells, and then to some extent for the CA1 cells, the elimination of those inputs is compromised when the cultures are grown in the presence of ATP. So what we're used to seeing in a normal condition is shown on the left-hand bar, a strong bias for the CA3 neurons. When you grow on APV, you no longer have a big distinction between the CA3 and dentate cells. This difference turns out still to be significant, so it can distinguish between these two cell types in the presence of an NMDA blocker. But clearly, compared to the level of discrimination before, it is significantly reduced. Right? So I would say that that it is likely that there's an activity component or an NMDA receptor dependent component that is required for the refinement of the connections. So to wrap up this part of the first part of the story, in this model system, what we think happens is an individual dentate neuron initially makes synapses with all the cell types that it contacts, or many of the cell types it contacts. It ends up refining its connection to the right cell types over a period of about a week, and that this refinement process has a requirement for NMDA receptors, because if you block it, it'll keep many of the incorrect synapses. So now, in the remainder of the talk, I want to discuss this issue of what might influence the stability of these inputs. So the model that I'm proposing is that what matters here is that, having made correct and incorrect synapses, or synapses onto correct and incorrect targets, you really want to stabilize only those synapses that are onto the correct targets and destabilize those that are onto incorrect targets. And to get a sense of the dynamics of the process and things that might influence the stability of these connections. We've been doing a lot of experiments, a lot of these are in cortical cultures, and many of you have seen these kinds of movies, but this is just to give you a sense of what the axon dendrite are actually doing during this process of synapse formation and decision making. So this is a field where there are two neurons that are transfected. There's the green is synaptophysin GFP transfection in one neuron, and then a postsynaptic cell, or putative postsynaptic cell, is labeled in red with TD tomato in this case, and you can get a sense of, if you focus in this area, you'll get a sense of the dynamics of the process, and you'll see that a lot of the growth and remodeling happens at the level of the dendrite. And I should again say that this general feature of dendritic remodeling has been seen in many places where it has been observed, and I think it's a fairly general feature. So in this particular case, you probably noticed that right here there was a little dendrite, it extended two little filipodia, and then it made a contact with this axon over here. You can even see what would seem like a little bridge or like a tension here because of the morphology of the axon. If I play it again, you'll see right exactly where the contact is. And this is a site that is a putative synaptic site, right? So there is, I think, a fair bit of evidence that part of what goes on during this period is that dendrites extend little filipodia, they'll contact axons, and some fraction of those will become stabilized to go on to become synapses. And so we were interested in learning a little bit about how these inputs become stabilized. So for the rest of the experiment, I'm going to switch to examples of cortical neurons. This just happens to be the system that this student was working on, but I think that the principles will very likely apply to the hippocampus as well. So this now is looking at the dynamics of the presynaptic inputs, the same synaptophysin GFP inputs, and we're going to look at the association of these inputs onto dendrites, onto sites that have particular receptors on the postsynaptic side, and how they change. And this shows an example of a single axon that we're imaging that has several synaptophysin GFP puncta, and if you look over time, you can see that this little spot stays here throughout, but then there'll be other puncta that will appear to move around or get eliminated and so on. And if you examine the distribution of these synaptophysin GFP puncta on an axon, and you image it over some period of time, in this case they're imaged over an hour, for example, you can assign dwell times to individual puncta based on when they appear and when they disappear from a particular location. And this just shows how the dwell times are assigned. This shows the distribution. And what I want to point out is that about half of the puncta that you see disappear over a fairly short period of time, and these would include the puncta that you're talking about that are probably trafficking synaptophysin GFP puncta. Whereas there are another half that are fairly stable. In this case, they're stable over a period of an hour. Right? This is all neocortex. This is not separated just for barrel cortex in the cultures over here. Okay, yeah. So this is like average cortex. All right. And so then we've been interested in what is determining the stability of those puncta that are stable versus those that are not stable, right? So the first thing is to look at the difference between those inputs that are in contact with the dendrite, because in this culture the axon is growing on, every once in a while it touches a dendrite. So you can ask that maybe everywhere it touches a dendrite, it is stable, and it's unstable when it's between dendrites. And what you find is that there are, so this shows the distribution of the puncta that are on dendrites or off dendrites. And the point that I want to make is that it's true that overall, the puncta that are on dendrites show a higher level of stability than the ones that are off, which kind of makes sense. The off ones probably have more trafficking puncta. But even on the puncta that are on dendrites, and therefore, you know, in a privileged position to make a synapse, there are still a lot of putative inputs that end up being transient. And these are the red bars over here. So you can see that a lot of them have half-lives that are less than 30 minutes, although they were in contact with dendrites at a particular point. Yeah.
What do you mean by not on dendrites?
So what I mean is, so in a culture, you can imagine there's an axon and a dendrite, right? So there's a point of intersection. So that would be a point where a synaptophysin GFP puncta is in contact literally with the position where there's a dendrite right there. So those would be the on dendrite spots. And when the axon is just growing on the substrate where it is not in contact with the dendrite, it's just growing over. That would be the behavior of the axon in a non-dendrite area. Right. So So we think that there is a signal on the dendrites that tends to preferentially stabilize the inputs. Although even on the dendrites, just because they're on the dendrite doesn't mean that they're stable forever. And so we just then got us thinking about the kinds of signals that might be present on dendrites that might influence the stability of the presynaptic input. And this is just a little cartoon to remind you that there are a lot of molecules that are present at the site of interaction between an axon and a dendrite that could influence this decision. So this is a cartoon of an axon terminal. This is a cartoon of a dendritic spine or dendritic filopodia. And so what you'll recognize right away are NMDA receptors, AMPA receptors, which we've discussed briefly before. Then there are other cell surface molecules, so F receptors, neural ligands, et cetera, that are all in the postsynaptic cell. And then there are a set of molecules in the presynaptic cell that could influence this decision in some way. And these could be read out by things that are on either side. So,
I wanted to get on the previous slide just some idea of the success rate of what was happening. That is, how many of those crossings do not occur, but there's no synapse that forms? I don't like to see a denominator for that red bar.
Where there's a crossing, but a synapse does not form.
Yeah.
So I don't have a number, so I shouldn't guess. However, I'll say that there are a lot of places where there are axon dendrite crossings where there's not a synapse. This is just kind of in these cultures.
Do you think that all crossings, 10% actually end up make synapses, or was there an estimate for that?
So,
No.
So here, what we're looking at is we're looking at puncta. So I should explain this better, right? So you're looking at an axon dendrite contact where there's a presynaptic synaptophysin GFP puncta at that site of intersection at the beginning of the imaging session, right? And then you're asking, if you move forward in time, will that be stable or is it something that is transient? Right, so this is scoring only those where there's a synaptophysin GFP puncta at that location. I think what Ken is asking, if you look at all crossings, how many of them have a synapse?
So the sum of all these red symbols is 1.
Yes, 100% right. Yeah, exactly.
Do you have some feel for that? I mean, just not as a calculated number, but just from your...
Yeah, observations. I would say that less than half is certainly the case, right? Within that range, it actually varies a lot. I mean, I think that if you look at, if you look at an individual axon, you'll see it go past neurons that's contacting dendrites, not making any synaptophysin GFP puncta. There'll be other axons that are in contact that'll make synapses on multiple dendrites onto a particular postsynaptic cell. So I think that. But I should also say that's kind of a snapshot at that given instant, right? Now, if I had to guess, if I had to integrate over time, right, which is to say that do I think that based on our imaging experiments, right, and the number of crossings we see, is it likely that an intersection will at some point in its history over a 24-hour period have a synapse? I think that number is very high. But a lot of these are very transient, right? Part of what kind of this data over here indicates, that even over an hour imaging session, half of the spots that are there are gone. And therefore, if you look at a given time, you're going to miss a lot of sites that, in fact, at some point had a presynaptic terminal associated with that site. You see what I'm saying? So I think if you integrate over time, I think that most sites are likely to have a transient synapse. But at any given time, you can have axons running across dendrites that don't have a synapse. So I think that one can draw that inference based on two observations. So one is that the longer that this input stays on a dendrite, there is an increased correlation of it having a larger presynaptic puncta size. And there is a correlation between the presynaptic puncta size and stability, as well as the presence of postsynaptic receptors. So I would, if you put those things together, I would say that there is a correlation between how long it stays and whether or not they'll become permanent. Right? But even then, it can be eliminated after some time. So here, for example, all these things that are at 60 minutes look pretty stable. If you increase the imaging window, I don't know if I have that picture, I don't. Over 6 hours, we can clearly see things that are stable for 3 hours and then get eliminated between 3 and 6 hours. So there doesn't seem to be a magic number that makes, you know, if you last for 3 hours, then you're good forever. But it definitely, I think, biases the decision in favor of a more stable outcome. Yeah.
I was thinking when you should have the review now, go to the same word, as you said, after 6 hours.
Yeah.
Would you still see this kind of exponential decay and then a large number?
Yeah, so what we tried to do, and so I'll just tell you, it's kind of soft math, that's why I didn't put it up there, is that you can calculate, you see this decay, and you can associate, you try to fit it with a certain number of exponentials, right? And you can actually fit it very well with either two or three exponentials with different taus. Yeah, so three exponential is a great fit. That's because in this 1 hour movie, right? I thought you're saying that if you take it out to 3 hours, right?
Oh, I see. Then it will not be.
Exactly. And I think so. My sense from those numbers, or my take on it, and it kind of relates to this kind of maybe sequential stability of a synapse model, is that. I think that one of two things happening, and I don't really know how to distinguish between them, right? Either there are, in fact, three different kinds of synapses that can form, right? That have somewhat different half-lives, and those are revealed in a six-hour session with three different half-lives of dissociation constant. So a dentate CA1, dentate CA3, for example, whatever. The other possibility is that even within the same target type, there is some accumulation of pre and postsynaptic proteins that need to happen to make the synapse stable, and that with each additional interaction that you're engaging, the half-life of dissociation of that kind of contact changes, right? And maybe that's what you're detecting. So for example, in a case like this, so let's say that the contact in the end is going to have both of these interactions, a near ligand direction interaction and efferent F interaction. Right? If you compare the dissociation of this kind of junction with one that did not have the efferent F interaction but only had this, then it might show a different decay kinetics. Right? And those are revealed as different taus.
So for instance, like in sort of consider an example from adult systems, when Larry out of the models step up to some Larry out of the models of synaptic plasticity, they model synaptic perturbations having certain equal levels or something.
Yeah.
LTP, and it's something that's sort of just like progressively deepened people into that state.
Yeah.
And likewise, you know, it's a common place for people to talk about different phases of LTP where you have something that's potentiated and then something that's sort of locked in and stays
right.
in.
Right.
And so you can have different degrees of stability of synaptic plasticity, and likewise, you can imagine all these things you can't see.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
That's conferring different degrees of stability.
Yeah, so I would say that the decay kinetics definitely suggests that it is not, especially in a long imaging period, it's not just one event, right? It's not an on or off kind of thing. It's not like you either have a stable synapse or you don't have it, but that with additional interactions, it falls into a state that is more stable.
Often the problem with these experimental measurements is that you're only visualizing one player in this whole complex.
If at all, right.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like determining how house is coming along by counting the
windows. But if you get the data, itself, can you tell whether this is the exponential versus the power law, for instance,
which
will come out
with
the kind of models that
Stefano
and
Lucy have? Oh, I mean, it sounds to me like, I don't know, I haven't seen these data, you spent a lot of time with these data. The primary distinction, for starters, is it looks like a single exponential or it doesn't.
So what I'm saying is that if you take a very short imaging window, and I think this is why it comes out, because in short, if you look at the events that are transient events, because that's what's problem. If you constrain yourself to events that happen, started and ended within an hour, you're dominated by one kind of molecular interaction, and that I think can be modeled by signal exponential. And as soon as you go to a longer period of time, for the same individual imaging events, you start revealing additional kinds of interactions.
But you may in general get some things that looks Because the reaction is complex, you have to go small, you go back,
Reaction.
Right?
Yeah.
If you have two reactions, yeah. Exponentially distributed, you sum them right. up, you don't get what somebody can, you don't get the exponential, single exponential. Yeah. Right. You don't even need this possible
mechanism. Yeah. I think my sense is that, again, from a modeling point of view, which we haven't done rigorously, I think looking carefully at the dissociation dynamics or kinetics of these things could probably provide some insight into the kind of event that might be determining whether or not a particular presynaptic input is stable or not.
Which multiple candidates for stabilization factors and compare,
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there could be that one of these things is really particularly important. Okay. So, yeah.
It's the two experiments. So I know that
you're
looking at that. What if you were to take a few viable candidates like the Asmund and put them into CA1 cells?
Yeah.
Could you make the NK prefer?
Yeah. So I can tell you about one candidate where this it does that. So first of all, I should mention that we actually have done the imaging experiment for CA3 versus CA1 and what the result is, right? So first of all, when you look at that, it is the case that, first of all, there's a lot of turnover both for dentate synapses onto CA3 and dentate synapses onto CA1. So it is not the kind, it's not an absolute recognition mechanism. It's not like if it makes a synapse onto CA3, it stays. If it makes a synapse onto CA1, it goes. Right? The difference is at the level of the half-life of the stability. So what you end up seeing is that when it makes a synapse on the CA1, it tends to make a shorter half-life contact and it then disappears. Whereas when it makes a contact on the CA3, it tends to fall in the longer period of removal. And that, amplified over 7 days, gives the CA3 neurons a big, big advantage in terms of total number of inputs it has. In terms of molecules that will affect it, so we've been looking at things that are differentially expressed that might be driving this thing. And one molecule that has an effect is KIRL3, which is a cell surface protein, immunoglobulin protein. It's also called SIG1 in worms. And it's a gene that's been implicated in synaptic specificity in C. elegans. If you express KIRL3 in CA1 cell, it will now receive inputs at the same rate as CA3 cells, and the kinetics will become the same. So it is possible for a single molecule to drive the process in a direction that makes it indistinguishable from the other ones. Whether or not KIRL3 is the right one, we don't know yet. But it does say that you probably don't need 15 molecules to be able to get the cell to show a dynamics in preference of one cell. Yeah.
It's also possible, hypothetically, that a molecule from the wall to wall. The
Yes, you're right. I mean, it is possible that the properties of the synapse or the current that the synapse carries could be different in a dentate CA3 versus dentate CA1 synapse that might drive it. I should say, however, that if you look at, but this is fairly limited data, but if you look at the minis made onto the two different cell types, they're not substantially different. So at the level of individual synapses when they're first being made, there's not a very clear difference. But that's kind of one somewhat crude measure.
Since you have an idea separate in wall, so yeah. I mean, you're basically talking about correlation between this NMDA receptor heaven sort of learning and the and some kind of chemical labels, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I'll try to bring the NMDA receptor back in a minute. I'm not.
There is a direct way of avoiding chemical labels at all. For example, if spike timing
dependent on CA1 versus CA3. So I'm not arguing that it is not possible to do it based on some activity property, but I'm saying just because it's possible to do it that way doesn't mean that's the way it does it, right? Okay. So I just want to kind of wrap up by a set of experiments that tests one particular component, and this is kind of motivated by the fact that which comes to this initial point, which is that the development of circuit has this feature of the amp current increasing as the circuits become more stable, right? And so So we thought that maybe the AMPA receptor plays an important role in regulating the stability of the synapse, not just as a transmitting unit, which is how it works in a mature synapse, but somehow helping determine whether or not a particular synapse is stable. So that you might imagine that the recruitment of AMPA receptors on the postsynaptic cell could have a causal influence on whether or not a particular synapse is stable. So we first started examining this, I'm going to skip this in the interest of time, by looking at the presence of NMDA AMPA receptors opposed to the presynaptic inputs in one of these imaging experiments. And we simply asked that when a presynaptic input is eliminated from a site, then are there postsynaptic receptors present at that site, and do they tend to be both AMPA and NMDA receptors, or is only one present? So these are just examples now of imaging sessions in which a puncta is present throughout a 6-hour imaging period, in one case where it shows up in this location, not present at this location, or an eliminated one where it's present in these locations but missing by the 6-hour period. And at the end of the imaging session, we fix the cultures and stain for AMPA and NMDA receptors, right? And what we find is, first of all, when you have a stable puncta like this, it is very, or generally it is associated with presence of both AMPA and NMDA receptors, which we kind of expect. But the interesting thing are these blue bars over here. So if you look at the eliminated sites, very often, or with a higher probability, they lack AMPA receptors, but not NMDA receptors, and that they still have NMDA receptors. So you can see a ghost site where the input used to be, and here's an example of, you can see the NR1 labeling is about the same whether it's a stable, new, or eliminated presynaptic input. Whereas if it is an eliminated site, both GluR1 and GluR2, which are AMPA receptor subunits, are present at a lower rate than you would find in the new and stable inputs. Okay. Yeah, this is at the end of a 6-hour experiment, right? So at an end of a 6-hour experiment, there is a correlation between eliminated sites and the absence of AMPA receptors. Now, this experiment doesn't really answer the question I posed, because it could either be the case that when an input is eliminated, very shortly after the AMPA receptors go away, because they require the presynaptic input for the receptors to stay, or it could be that the receptors get eliminated by some mechanism, molecular mechanism or activity-dependent mechanism, and then that drives a process that leads to the elimination of the inputs, right? So one way to test it is to ask that if you take a normal neuron and you down-regulate the amount of surface AMPA receptors, will you affect the number of inputs onto that cell? And we can do this by expressing a construct that has the C-terminus domain of AMPA receptors, which has been shown by several people, including Holly and Robert Malino, that will affect trafficking of AMPA receptors to the surface. And then we can ask whether or not the number of inputs onto the dendrites is affected by manipulating AMPA receptors in this way. So these are examples where there's a control neuron. This is a neuron that's been transfected with the C-tails of GluR1 and GluR2. You can see nice-looking dendrites in both cases. Then you look at the number of inputs onto these cells. Here's stained with V-glute, and you can visually see that the number of inputs has decreased, and it's quantified over here, that reducing the number of AMPA receptors reduces the number of inputs that we see onto the postsynaptic cell. Now, the experiments that I'm not going to show, but I'll just mention, is that we've done the same thing with imaging to show that when you get rid of the AMPA receptors in the postsynaptic cell, the stability of the synaptophysin GFP onto the dendrites is greatly reduced. And conversely, if you overexpress AMPA receptors, you can increase the number of inputs onto those cells.
So right? I don't know what these constructs actually are.
Yeah.
Should read the literature. Are these soluble proteins?
Yes. And
so they're not
to the membrane. No, they're not to the membrane. They're competing with some mechanism that drives trafficking. Right? Now, so I just want to make one important point, which is that this is not a consequence of just reduced activity in the cell. In other words, it's not the case that, oh, well, you reduce the total number of AMPA current, the cell's not firing so much, and therefore reduce the synaptic input. And an experiment that I think is particularly telling is if you do a similar experiment but block AMPA receptors with a drug, with CNQX, you actually get the opposite effect, an effect that has been described by others. It's a scaling effect. So what the cell normally tries to do if you reduce AMPA currents is it tries to increase the number of inputs. Right? So this is not in response to reduced activity. It is a response to the absence, I think, of a physical receptor.
Do you think there's some, basically, the AMPA receptor of subclusterin is nucleating the scaffolding phenomena, or it's participating in the scaffolding?
That's right, exactly. So I think there's an AMPA receptor-associated complex of some kind that is helping stabilize the synapse.
So could it not as a channel, but as a piece of scaffolding?
That's right.
But couldn't it also, with the lack of AMPA receptors, aren't you like they have less calcium influx?
Well, that's the thing. So then the blocking experiment should have the same result.
Oh, sure.
Right? So I don't think that's what's going on, right? Yeah. No.
Well, I don't know how much people think about these ideas about channels playing some structural role. For instance, like, the engine cells have like a formulary receptor, so I mean, it's in a functional channel. So these guys are floating around and could do things a lot.
Well, yeah, it's not a question to make all these proteins, but whole alarm or
right.
So, you know, the way I look at it is not just the B cell, but also, it's very, you know, you tend to think of single molecules, but basically, that kind of thing, that kind of situation, even once the ability starts to be nucleated, all the proteins are, to a first approximation, are in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the channels are there with all this, you know, the linker protein, with all the transmembrane proteins that are setting up, you know, the adhesion proteins, they're all going to be physically very close.
Right.
And so if you take out one that's whose stoichiometry is
critical, then you might
affect the whole thing.
Right.
Or you might change,
Yeah, so I think, I'll tell you one experiment. The reason I think it's very closely associated with the receptor, as opposed to many steps away, is so we did a heterologous cell experiment. So we can take a 293 cell, which will receive synaptic inputs if you express something like neuroligand onto the cell, right? And then we can ask that, can we affect the stability of that input just by expressing AMPA receptors? And we can. Now, it probably has a bunch of other proteins in that cell, but it probably doesn't have a regular postsynaptic scaffolding complex. So an extreme example is that it's something like the ectodomain of the receptor is somehow interacting with something on the axon, right? Before which you don't have any direct evidence. Or it could be something that is very just directly associated with the receptor as opposed to several steps away. And so that's something that we're trying to see whether we can tease out to see if it's the receptor itself.
So, yeah. The initial reason I published a paper where you suggest that the C terminus of VR2 is going to do with you see this? But this came out.
Yeah, so.
You try to reconstitute knockout neurons with different constructs of VR2.
Yeah, so I think that's by a slightly different experiment, and maybe Holly can comment on this more. So there are two points. One is whether or not normally the C-tail is driving trafficking. In this case, we're just using it as a tool to affect trafficking. So here we have confirmed, in fact, that the C-tail construct reduces the amount of surface AMPA receptors. Holly has published that the AMPA currents are reduced when you express these things. So as a gain of function reagent, it definitely works. But I'm not making a claim about whether this is a normal trafficking mechanism. Right? So I'm going to close with this model, and then you guys can think about it, or we can talk about it over dinner. So as far as we can tell, it seems that the synapse kind of toggles between these two states, one that is dominated by NMDA receptors, or maybe only has NMDA receptors, and one that also has AMPA receptors, and maybe some AMPA receptor-associated protein, which is the way I've drawn it over here. And what I would propose is that the initial synapses are made and can break fairly easily, and they're probably this kind of synapse in most cases. But that within a certain amount of certain window of time, and that might be an hour or whatever, if it recruits AMPA receptors or AMPA receptor associated proteins, then its stability or the likelihood of it becoming stable increases quite dramatically. And that then as the network develops, it might do it in this way where it is kind of all potential synapses it can make, it is kind of anchoring some of these synapses by regulating the AMPA receptors at those synapses, so then it becomes a normal AMPA to NMDA receptor containing synapse, and then that point is set. And I think that it'll be, you know, in addition to figuring out what the real mechanism here is by which the AMPA receptors might play such a role, I think computationally it's an interesting question, and maybe people here have suggestions as to whether or not this way of So what we're imagining here is if you have a network that initially has fairly weak connectivity, as reflected by small amplicurrents, is evolving by setting individual points and driving them to a high amplicurrent level, whether that provides certain advantage in terms of figuring what the network eventually is supposed to do, as opposed to increasing the strength of all the synapses at once or starting with synapses that are all comparably strong. So anyway, I'm going to stop over here, and I'll be happy to take questions or additional discussion. Yeah. Let me turn these lights on.
So when from this is a stable synapse, it can go back to the unstable synapse, and unstable synapse can again form a stable synapse. Do you think in that case, when an unstable synapse can make a stable synapse, do you think that there will be new synthesis of the AMPA receptor locally at the synaptic sites and can be inserted into the membrane?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that, so this receptor, it's a good question, because we actually do not know what exactly the fate of this receptor is, but we know many things can happen to it, right? So I would say that there are three major pathways for this receptor to go. One is for it to be internalized, so that it's inside the cell, but close to the synapse. For it to slide away from the synapse, so there's evidence that the AMPA receptors can kind of traffic, or not traffic, can move along the surface of the postsynaptic cell, so that if it moves away from this site over here, then it is no longer affecting the presynaptic input, but can be recruited to this site pretty easily. And the last one is physical degradation, so there's evidence that AMPA receptors could get degraded, or degradation could affect the stability of a synapse, in which case it could be that this thing is completely destroyed, in which case you would need new synthesis of AMPA receptors. I think that overall there's probably more evidence in favor of existing AMPA receptors moving in and out of synaptic locations than being locally synthesized, but I think that that could happen as well.
Your cultures are purely excitatory, there's no inhibitory neurons in
there? No, there are also inhibitory
neurons in the cultures.
We are examining, so there are two things. One is that most of the synapses, or most of the cells are excitatory cells. About in the cortex, about 70% of cells are excitatory cells. But there are inhibitory cells in the culture as well. And we don't know about their contribution or their development very much.
Of course, you know, they don't play any role in this question of stability or...
So let's see, have we tested it directly?
You're not visualizing them, so you don't know this inhibitory structure near these stable.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point in part because the gap,
you can put at least,
if we don't call it inhibitory, also has a very interesting behavior that is temporally coincident with this period of stability. So GABA, which is the main inhibitory transmitter, is in fact depolarizing early in development, and that's why I was not using the term inhibitory. And it's depolarizing because the transporter that normally sets the chloride gradient later on in life is absent early on. And so the chloride gradient is opposite. So when the channel opens, chloride goes out of the cell instead of coming into the cell.
So these are developmentally at which stage?
These are all in the first 2 weeks when, for much of that period, GABA is depolarizing. But it switches to hyperpolarizing at a time that is close to when the synapses or the circuit starts to become more stable. So it could be that the depolarizing GABA plays an important role. And I think, Holly, I don't know, are you going to talk about your GABA depolarizing stuff here? Yeah. Okay, anyway, I think there's evidence that the depolarizing GABA plays an important role in the development of synapses as well. Yeah.
Did you say you knew there are differences between neural and AMPA receptors and see
So neural ligand, clearly there's no difference. And FNF receptor, I'm not sure whether that's a difference or not. So I should say that there are other families of surface molecules that are differentially expressed that are very interesting. So we've just started investigating them, and so they include these chiral proteins. There are a number of leucine-rich proteins, leucine-rich transmembrane proteins that show very interesting differential expression. So those could play a role. Holly. Yeah.
It looks as if the ones that were preserved were not computed
very well. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Nevertheless, it looks as if they're clusters or several splotches of AMPA receptors.
Right.
So maybe there's actually convergence. You can see one pathophysic company, but you can't see others.
And there's other ones nearby.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we think that's what actually stabilizes, that there's a convergence in between several cells.
It's possible. I mean, there clearly, again, you know, this is now we're somewhat in the domain of anecdote, but it has certainly been my impression from looking at these things, both in terms of inputs onto particular cells or stability of presynaptic inputs, is that you will often see what seems to be a local effect on stability, where there'll be several inputs in one region that seem to be co-stable. And that could be because the local activity around dendrite is likely to be very similar because of the inputs that come into that position, or it could be a diffusion of a signal that acts over some space constant of, you know, 10 microns or something like that. Yeah, on the one that got eliminated, and here it could be that this is just an elimination zone.
By the way, if you've got some kind of control or statistical function to see whether this impact is not due to just some global differences in the amount of AMPA receptor, you want to ask me?
Global differences.
Well, I see. Okay, so to not talk about it in terms of receptors, yeah, in terms of their thoughts.
Yeah.
In this one down here, there aren't any
methods,
and so there's
some
variation.
Yeah, no, right. So that we've done to make sure that, like, if you look over fields of view, it's not like they're that. So this local effect that I'm describing is usually, you know, restricted to a small segment of axon or dendrite within maybe about 10 microns, as opposed to a field of view which might be like, you know, 200 microns square, where in that whole field, AMPA receptors are not stabilizing. So there's no big spatial effect like that. So.
Does glia contribute to this synaptic specificity or changing the receptor distribution in the postsynaptic effects? Because in brain we have neurons with glia, and in your culture's model system you also grow neurons.
Right. Yeah.
So does glia play any role?
So we haven't examined the glia effect very thoroughly, although I think Ben Barris has a lot of experiments suggesting that there's a glial factor that is required in that case for function of, you know, ganglion cell, retinal ganglion cell synapses. So I think it's likely that the glia are producing factors that might promote synapse maturation, although since they're present throughout the field, they probably do not help distinguish between different kinds of inputs or different kinds of postsynaptic cells. Right? But again, you know, glia are somewhat not very well understood because maybe there's diversity among glia, and although we put them on a bed of glia, you know, it's possible that there are, you know, maybe glia that promote synapse formation or something like that. And
well, I mean, there's a more fundamental thing, which is like the Ben's most recent paper. It's, I think, in some ways, was relative to the deposition of complement proteins on parts of cells is, I mean, it's bizarre, and the interpretation of the result is, to me, unclear. But in that case, you know, what you're growing these cells on are basic GFAP positive
astrocytes. Yeah.
They may be diverse set of astrocytes, but they're astrocytes. So the phenomenon that you're looking at is really, at least in terms of the interpretation, is a cell autonomous intrinsic process.
Yeah.
But one of the possibilities that's raised by this in this recent cell paper, which I think is probably ridiculous, it's never articulated, but it's nonetheless the conclusion, is that there's a component to things which could be an active process of macrophage like microglia in the brain actually going in and ripping things apart, you know?
Yeah.
That's not actually discussed in the paper, but that's the clear implication of what they're talking about. Mechanistically, I don't actually know how else it could apply. So when you talk about glia, there is this other population of cells that you have to start thinking about, which are these phagocytic cells. I mean,
it does
discuss the idea that, you know, you can't remove part of the cell without getting rid of the entire cell. That's another thing to think about. I think it's unlikely. I mean, clearly, you know, Audubon's thinking, almost everybody's thinking, talking about communication between two cells, and that under some circumstances one part of the synapse just gives up, or there's some process that forces it to give up. But there's this other possibility, there are cells actually in the brain which are going in and
removing parts of cells.
And seeing we're talking about evolution throughout this meeting, this one must, especially seeing you didn't bring this up, Greg's talked about how you could hijack sort of classic immune reactions to mediate some of this pruning. And so just...
There's some evidence. I mean, there's evidence in pathological circumstances when you damage the nervous system and where you induce inflammation and trauma, that there are populations of phagocytic cells that will do this, both in the cells that are endogenous to the brain microglia and macrophages that come in from the immune system. So that definitely happens under circumstances of trauma, but in normal development, I don't think there's really any evidence for this. So the evidence in Ben's paper, if you have mice that lack a complement protein, right, that they don't do a very good job in refinement of retinal geniculate connection between the two lines. So in that competitive circumstance, although the data even there, they don't exactly go your way. Right. But nonetheless, I think it's a phenomenon that's probably real. And the real question is, which synapses have the C1q? Is it the synapses that are going to be eliminated?
I mean, along the lines of this AMPA receptor playing a role in stability, I think another observation is this observation of I think beta amyloid affecting AMPA receptor levels? No. Yeah. And that might contribute to the loss of synapses in Alzheimer's disease. I guess after doing these experiments, I'm more sold on this idea that that regulating the AMPA receptors is a pretty important place in terms of regulating the stability, strength, or survival of a synapse. And I think that it's exactly how it does and how many other proteins are affected is not really known. But I think that this general concept that the same unit that is driving transmission and how much current is coming through is also playing a role in determining whether or not that synapse stays, I think is an interesting connection and might be important in the way the system.
Could just be the increased current triggering other events.
Well, that's why I gave you that one example. At least in this case, it's not an increased current thing. So I should say that complementarily, there are other observations. Morgan Cheng has an experiment showing in terms of spine structure that the extracellular domain of the AMPA receptor can affect spine stability without a current component. So I don't know if anyone knows about the evolution of these receptors. I mean, if they have a history where they used to do something before they started transmitting current.
I've always thought that a lot of these membrane proteins, like GPCRs, actually start out of scaffold proteins and eventually get adapted to channel or receptor. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if we found that out. But that could be the original use.
Right.
In C. elegans, is it known?
Well, the C. elegans has AMPA receptors, GluR receptors that can function as regular neurotransmitter receptors, as far as people can tell. So I don't know if there's an organism in which there's a truly identifiable AMPA receptor that is, in fact, not also a glutamate receptor, but. Maybe we don't have the right kind of evolutionary biologists in this room to answer that question.
The C-terminal domains of the proteins are they related to many, many other proteins.
Exactly.
They're not
right.
Part of receptors. So, right. You have a genetic shuffling event, and you would stick those on?
Yeah, there could be all kinds of things. I think you wouldn't really look at the reference. So, for instance, plants have
glutamate receptors
that are blocked by CNQX. Okay, they're ion channel, and so this ion channel function goes back to, things that aren't animals.
Yeah, or it's present in things that are not animals.
Yeah.
Right. But the AMPA receptor has a big ectodomain that could mediate some of these interactions that's not probably critical for ion channel function.